Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-3012, United States of America versus Ricardo Palmera Pineda, also known as Simon Trinidad, appellant. Mr. Tucker for appellant, Ms. Heffernan for appellee.
Good morning. I represent the appellant, Mr. Ricardo Palmera Pineda. I will refer to him by the name of Simon Trinidad or Mr. Trinidad because that's how he was referred to consistently during the trial.
You were trial counsel, weren't you?
Yes, I was. Mr. Trinidad is 59 years old. He is presently serving a 60-year sentence in the maximum security penitentiary at ADX. Given his age, he will, unless he obtains appellate relief, he'll die in a United States prison. When you look at this record, and what the jury really found for passing a message, that's it. That's what this jury, when you look at the record here, is the only conclusion you can draw. After four trials, two on this and two on a drug conspiracy in the district court, one conviction on this count of conspiracy, after the jury had sent a note saying we're hung, after they first sent a note saying, asking the judge, well, you've instructed in the conspiracy instruction that a minor role is enough. Apparently having problems with whether or not Mr. Trinidad had even had a minor role, they send a note saying, well, what about any role? Will that do? And at that point in time, the court answers, yeah, any role. They come back the next day and say, well, we can't reach a verdict on anything. At that point in time, the court then, sua sponte, gives them a partial verdict instruction, even though they'd given no indication whatsoever that they were hung, that they had reached a, had reached a verdict or agreement on any issue, none whatsoever, even though the court had basically given that instruction in its main charge already. They then go out, and the following day, they come back with another note and say, well, you said, is preparation enough? Is preparation to act enough? And the court basically said that you determined that was basically the answer there. Then they come back with a verdict of guilty on the conspiracy count, but say, we can't reach a verdict on any other count. They're then given a Thomas instruction, sent back again, and eventually, after another note, they report, we're hung, we can't decide. Obviously, this was a compromise verdict. There's no question about that when you read this record. There's no logical way you could interpret this any other way, because the court had instructed them that if you find them guilty on count one, the conspiracy, you have to find them guilty on counts two through four. The substantive counts, not to mention that the material aid count would have fallen too. But regardless of that, this jury clearly compromised. They clearly had all sorts of questions, and this man is serving essentially the rest of his life because the jury found, after much disagreement and two trials, that he went to pass a message. That's it. The issue in this case, the most critical issue in this case that everybody recognized in the trial, was what was his intent when he traveled to Quito, Ecuador. Now, the other defenses that were denied, the military orders defense, the necessity defense, it all eventually just came down. The only defense that was allowed was the intent defense. The government claimed that his intent was to act in furtherance of this conspiracy. The defendant said, no, I never had no thought whatsoever about these three Americans. I was given no instructions about the three Americans. I was said nothing whatsoever about them, and they weren't even on my mind. This issue had been long preceded they're being taken captive. Now, we have raised six issues here. Four of the issues really go to that Quito trip. The three instructions all go, that the three instructional errors are all related to that. And then the issue that I would like to concentrate on here, the FARC evidence, is related to that too, because what the government did here, they realized there had already been one hung jury anyway, that this issue, the government tried to say harmless error many, many times in its brief. Oh, well, just that's okay, it's harmless error. Well, it wasn't harmless. This case was at the tipping point. As the verdicts indicate, and what the government did to try to get that jury to look at it their way was introduce massive amounts of evidence that the FARC are bad guys. That was it. That was their approach to this case. Now, we, from the beginning of this case, if you look through the record, you will see motion after motion after motion to sever, in limine, addressing issues through status conferences, pleadings, several motions in limine where we said basically the issue is how much is the government going to be allowed to go beyond the four corners of this indictment. Now, we have not raised, I think it's important for the court to understand this, we have not raised issues here, even though we did in the district court, about much 404B evidence that was introduced in this case. We haven't raised that. They introduced evidence from these witnesses known as reinsertados, who have basically left the FARC and who many of them are working for the Colombian Army. Their credibility is very questionable, as the jury obviously found in all these cases. And that Mr. Trinidad supposedly had been involved in kidnappings years before, several years before. That was first. So they had that 404B evidence. They were allowed to introduce over our objection that the FARC, when it took control of this DMZ, this area of Colombia that was ceded to them for the purposes of this peace conference for several years or 3 or 4 years or whatever it was, that they had introduced a law called 002, which basically said that if you don't come in and pay your taxes, we will detain you. They were allowed to introduce that. We objected to that, but that theory was, well, they were detaining people, so that could come in. We haven't raised that. Where the line should have been drawn, I suggest, was activity that was connected to Mr. Trinidad, but we haven't raised that. We haven't raised an issue about them allowing evidence that the FARC had been designated a foreign terrorist organization, even though that was an element. He was not an element. He was not charged with lending aid to a designated foreign terrorist organization, where, that, of course, that would be admissible. They were allowed to introduce evidence that the FARC had been declared a terrorist organization by the European Union, that the United Nations had criticized them, that Amnesty had criticized them. All this evidence came in. We haven't objected to that. Where we've drawn the line here, we do think much of that evidence that wasn't connected to Mr. Trinidad shouldn't have kept in. But where we've drawn the line here was the egregious evidence for which there's no reasonable explanation other than the FARC, the government's attempt to convict the FARC by getting the jury to think these are bad guys and he's associated with them and they are bad guys. To give you an example, the issue of whether one witness starts out, and this starts at the very beginning, the government is trying to say, well, we were just responding to you saying, the FARC is a noble organization or whatever. We never said that, first of all. I urge the court to look closely at the record, the opening statements, and the way this evidence developed. If you look at the opening statements here, you will see from the jump they started that they got up and told the jury that they're a terrorist organization. They have people in jail, hundreds of people convicted of murder, terrorism, kidnapping, had nothing to do with Mr. Trinidad. That's number one. But then with the first two witnesses were just witnesses from this company that had the contract to do these flyovers. So there wasn't a lot of about that other than this issue of what the three Americans were really doing. But then they called their first witness, their very first witness, before we even breathed, they put that other stuff in. But their very first witness starts saying, well, you know, the FARC blows up social clubs. They kill many innocent civilians. They kill children. They kill elderly people. They cause amputations. None of that had anything whatsoever to do and shed no light whatsoever on Mr. Trinidad's intent when he traveled to Quito. They've destroyed, they've sunk the country into poverty. Many of these questions were some of them were non-responsive to the, even to the government. But the government should not get a pass on this because the witness said the very same thing in non-responsive answers in the first trial. We pointed that out in a lengthy motion in limine before the second trial. He shouldn't be allowed to say this stuff. They obviously took no steps whatsoever to control these witnesses. And objections were just summarily overruled. Then they were allowed to introduce the speech of one of the FARC leaders, where he does say in the speech, and we didn't object to this, that you should attempt to locate gringos. Okay, we didn't object to that. Okay, that's close enough. But he also urging that the troops assassinate mayors, governors, judges, congressmen. None of that shed any light on anything. Nothing whatsoever. Then they got into hijacking airplanes. Then they got into the murder. I'd also ask the court, I think you have to look very closely at these rationales that are being put forth on appeal, because they are totally illogical. They don't follow, many of them. And this is a perfect example. They were allowed to introduce evidence concerning the murder of the Colombian minister of culture, a woman named Consuelo Aruja. Now, she had been taken, Mr. Trinidad knew her their families grew up next to each other. And in fact, they were some sort of distant relatives. So they were allowed to introduce the fact that Miss Aruja was taken during the peace negotiation by the FARC. But you have to understand that the FARC, these peace negotiations are in the southern part of Colombia. These events take place in the north, totally separate. You know, the FARC is spread out entirely throughout the country. So the evidence was that Mr. Trinidad had told the FBI agent that he went to the leaders of the FARC and asked that she be released. And he testified later, yeah, I did. It was for several reasons. You know, I knew her, and also because of the fact that it created a real issue in these discussions. It was a distraction in the discussions. So they were allowed to introduce evidence that he went and asked the FARC leadership that, because he testified, and there was no evidence that he's a member of the Central Committee or the General Staff of the FARC at all, for her release. Well, the theory was, well, that showed his status, that he had some juice, to speak colloquial. He could go to the leadership and ask for her release. And we said, well, that may be true, but the fact that she was later killed, apparently she was killed by the FARC, that doesn't show anything whatsoever on this issue. If you want to show that he had juice, okay. But you're just putting that in for prejudicial purposes, unduly and unfairly prejudicial. Had no relation to anything. Now they come in, and if you look at the record here, you'll see in both trials, they were unable and never said a word as to why that should be admissible. Now, Judge Hogan in the first trial did say, well, you know, I don't think it's unduly prejudicial because it shows he tried to win a release. Well, they took care of that in the second trial. The FBI agent drops in out of the blue in a narrative answer, totally out of the blue, just drops in, oh, Mr. Trinidad, and this is false, Mr. Trinidad was implicated in that. Totally out of the blue. Hearsay, that's so inadmissible on so many different grounds. So then what they coming in now and they say, well, you know, it's admissible to show that he wasn't really just carrying a note. Well, how would that
work? Mr. Tucker, you're just about out of time. Let me ask you this. Yes. What is there in the record, putting aside the your opening remarks about the the jury's timing and so on, what is there what reason is there to doubt that the result would have been the same absent this evidence that you're complaining about?
Well, I think in general that you have such a close case. When you have close case like this, when you have evidence.
Well, why is it close? You're saying the government did not make out its case without reference to this evidence? That it didn't prove the elements here? There isn't evidence of the elements?
I think that's a sufficiency argument and not a harmless error review.
Fair enough, but you'll grant that, right?
I grant the evidence is sufficient, absolutely.
Okay. All right, so now the question under Kadiakos is whether there's a high probability that the outcome would have been affected.
On that particular claim, that would be the standard review on that one.
Yeah.
You know, I've concentrated on that one because it was so disturbing from our perspective, this trial. But the standards of review are, of course, different on
but
the other
claim. You've got a complaint about, let's say, 20 items of evidence, all of which go to how bad the FARC is.
Right. Right.
And I'm not sure why that's any more powerful than one item of evidence like that. It's all cumulative. They're bad. That was put in. Maybe it's irrelevant. What is it? What do you have to suggest that the Kadiakos standard would have been met?
Well, I think you can never know for sure, but from our view.
Well, high probability is the Supreme Court's
threshold.
High
probability, and we think there's a high probability that a jury in a close question, in a close case, is going to be influenced by the fact that the defendant is a member of a group. This is the whole thing behind the concept of guilt by association, that the defendant is a member of a group that commits all these.
Well, let's go back then to whether it's a close case. We've acknowledged there's sufficient evidence, but what makes it a close case?
Makes it a close case because this defendant had never seen the Americans, had never talked to them, had nothing whatsoever to do with their capture.
Well, the government's theory of the case is that he became a member of this conspiracy after the kidnapping, not before, and he doesn't need to have done any of those things in order to have become a member of the conspiracy.
I understand that, but that's still those factors weigh into whether or not the government's proved beyond a reasonable doubt. But it's not only that. He never made a demand. He never talked to anyone about the Americans. No one ever spoke to him about the Americans. He told the FBI.
The FARC is framing him with their communiques? Hardly. You never suggested that.
I don't think I
can. So the FARC's evidence, the FARC in its own words, commissions him to act as its agent here, doesn't it?
The FARC did say.
And he seems to have accepted the commission.
Well, he said he never did. He said he never did because they never talked to him about it. Now, the April 27th commission does say that he and the others, there were three, stand ready to assume their duties once these conditions have been met. None of the conditions had ever been met. The talks weren't in Colombia. There had never been a DMZ. None of these conditions ever been met. And also, I'd like to focus your attention on
that's all he did? What if that's all he said? I'll be happy to do that if the conditions are met. Hasn't he just joined the conspiracy?
He didn't say you. That's what they said. That's what they said. Are you going? Is he guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, or is that how relevant is that they are saying that in a communique? Who knows? They may not even. He testified. I wasn't even with the leadership at this point in time. I heard about this when it was posted on a FARC bulletin board in the camp where I was. Nobody had ever discussed this with me. Now the FARC may have, obviously, because he's required to obey orders, may have obviously assumed he's going to do it. But the point is that he wasn't there. Nobody spoke to him about it. And I want to call your attention to his testimony that the FBI agent said. That he said, he told me, I don't even know if the Americans are dead or alive. I don't even know. And the government had introduced other evidence that one of the main things that you want to do with the proof of life or anybody making a demand is you want to assure that the people to whom you're making the demand that the hostages are in fact alive and well.
Is there any doubt that he negotiated before on behalf of the FARC and other matters?
Oh, absolutely, during the peace process, absolutely. There's no doubt whatsoever about
that.
He
was their representative in other matters.
Oh, absolutely.
Kidnappings?
We would say no, absolutely. He testified absolutely not.
So we have the Visigoth saying, "Sack of Rome, I was across town planting trees."
Well, that
I mean, they may be right.
May be right.
Okay. Thank you, right. Mr. Tucker. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Patricia Heffernan on behalf of the United States. In this case, the objective evidence establishing the elements of the offense of conspiracy was overwhelming.
Such that it's of no moment how much irrelevant and inflammatory information was put before the jury?
We would disagree that it was irrelevant, but yes, Your Honor.
You agree that it was inflammatory?
I don't agree that it was unduly, unfairly prejudicial. We think that the evidence was relevant, and its probative value was not substantially outweighed by
What was the probative value of portraying all the crimes that the FARC has committed?
Well,
unrelated to this crime and this defendant.
First of all, I would say that the government didn't. The crimes that the FARC has committed are vast. The gross human rights violations. This trial wasn't about that. These were specific.
Well, like to read the transcript, one would wonder.
I mean, that's precisely the point. You're absolutely right. It wasn't about that, but there's an awful lot of testimony.
The government put in specific acts that actually were tied to the defendant. The defendant was negotiating at the peace talks on behalf of the FARC when these two different hijackings took place and when the Prime Minister Arujo was kidnapped. It shows that he's aware of the kind of activity that the FARC is engaging in. His whole defense was, "I'm a humanitarian." A humanitarian is someone who works for the welfare of the good and the good of the people. And so it was relevant evidence to show when he accepted this agreement to negotiate on behalf of the FARC, he knew exactly what was going on. He tried to put himself...
Well, you mean to say he knew the FARC were a bunch of criminals?
He knew...
So what?
Well, because his defense is, I could never harbor this criminal intent because I'm a humanitarian. I would never get myself involved in a criminal conspiracy because I'm a humanitarian. And this evidence showed that he knew exactly what was going on in the conspiracy, and
I'm not following this at all. How did it show that he knew what was going on in this alleged conspiracy? To have general information about FARC and how bad they are, what does that have to do with this particular case?
The burden's
not on him. He didn't have to say anything. He didn't have to say he was a humanitarian or a non-humanitarian. The burden's on the government, and the burden's on the government to show no harmless error.
And I'd like to get to that in a minute, the harmlessness of, to the extent the court were to determine there was any error, it would be harmless. But the theory of the defense, and it's right that pretrial, that the government also moved pretrial. We wanted to keep out the 20-year history of the FARC. But it was the defense that insisted that all of this was relevant, that the jury needed to make its judgments about the FARC and figure out who's the good guy and who's the bad guy down in Colombia and what about the United States' involvement in Colombia. And
Your argument is we didn't want to do it, but the defendant made us put in prejudicial testimony?
No, my argument
is... It doesn't make any sense. It's your case. I've never heard the U.S. attorney come in here and say the defendant made us do it. You decide what case to put on. And if it's a prejudicial case, then when you're on appeal, you have to explain how do you get away with it.
Well, I think
you have a heavy burden on harmless error. It's highly prejudicial stuff.
The government was entitled to rebut the defense theories about how the people that they were holding were combatants. The whole theory was, jury, this is a war. You need to consider this in war context. These are prisoners of war. And we were entitled to meet that evidence with evidence that those arguments with evidence that these aren't prisoners of war. They're not combatants. These are rounding up a bunch of senators and holding them hostage, making yourself out to be army personnel, tricking them into a bus and taking them and kidnapping them, kidnapping the culture minister, going up to a police station in the middle of the night, in the middle of nowhere, where the police are the only sense of law and order there.
How does that implicate this individual in the alleged act of conspiracy?
First of all, it responds to their defense theories. Now, there's an argument to be made that these defense theories were irrelevant, but they were before the jury, and the government was entitled to respond to them. And it also shows that the appellant, he's a high-ranking FARC member, and he's going to negotiate on behalf of the FARC, and he knows the kinds of activities the FARC is engaging in, and it belies his argument that his only position, his only concern, is that of a humanitarian, when what he's really doing is, in this particular case, is signing on to negotiate to make sure that the FARC gets its demands met before these prisoners or these hostages are released, that he is agreeing that he's with the FARC's program. And it's not credible, setting aside the objective evidence, which we'll get to in a minute, the defense theory that he's a humanitarian. He's a person of goodwill. He works for the good of the people. And his reason in joining the FARC is to help the campesinos. But in fact, what the FARC is doing is attacking the civilians and attacking the peasant populations. And so that evidence was relevant for those reasons.
Is it fair to say that, in your account, the defense was in part, look, this is a war, the FARC is an army, and not my army. And your response is, no, it's a terrorist organization, and you're in the thick of it.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And getting to the harmlessness, if the court were to determine that any of this evidence should not have been admitted, with respect to the agreement, the communique, and all this is uncontested, really, the communique said that he had been named to negotiate and that he was ready to assume that responsibility. He agreed with that. He testified that he agreed with the terms of the communique. He was prepared to negotiate. I think he said at trial he would do it that day. He said, to be honest, Mr. Cole, yes, that's right. He would not have declined or made some alternate proposal. He admitted to the FBI and to the court in Ecuador in his prior testimony that he was in Ecuador to comply with the mission. He looked for false ID so that he could go abroad in the event that that situation arose to negotiate on behalf of the FARC. And then there's the post-arrest communique, which said that the appellant went to Quito with the intention of finding a definite solution to the captivity of these hostages. So that's all uncontested, overwhelming evidence that he agreed with this communique. He agreed with the appointment. He agreed to join this conspiracy to detain the Americans.
Overwhelming evidence of that, or it's overwhelming evidence that the FARC said that?
Well, we have all of his admissions. I'm not just focusing on the communique. We have his admissions that, yes, the communique, it's authentic. I agree with it. I agree with its terms. The terms were, we're appointing Simone Trinidad to negotiate the FARC's interests. And with respect to his intent to detain the Americans, that evidence was also overwhelming. He testified that when he traveled to Quito, he believed that the FARC should not release the hostages until its demands were met. He admitted that he believed these Americans ought to be detained until a FARC got what it wanted. He refused the FBI request to intervene on behalf of the Americans, again, indicating, because he wouldn't betray the FARC, indicating that he's with the conspiracy. He agrees that they ought to be detained, and it's his purpose that they be detained until the FARC gets what it wants. He also sent out, there's the letter, the February 2006 letter, where he...
Because you agree with a perceived conspiracy makes you a part of it?
He agreed to participate in the conspiracy.
Well, it was. Where did that come from?
Because he accepted his role.
He accepted an assignment to negotiate. Does that mean he was a conspirator in capturing and detaining? Does that follow?
It does follow.
Not the capturing.
The crime here is the continued detention of the hostages. And he agreed in the government's view, he was one of the most important people with respect to this conspiracy. You know, you had 12 and 13-year-olds guarding the hostages.
When you start that way, that's not very helpful in the government's view. So what? We're looking at the record. So what does the record say about it? I don't really care what your view is.
I care what
the record says.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will like to rephrase that. This hostage-taking conspiracy doesn't go anywhere. They're all sitting in the jungles until somebody is going to be the face of the FARC. with respect to the Colombian government. And so he was a key player in that. Now, the fact that he, in his own mind, doesn't think he committed an offense, or the fact that the conspiracy wasn't successful, doesn't mean that
he didn't... Can you be a negotiator and not be a co-conspirator, in your view?
Can you be
a... Now I'm asking you your view. Can you be a negotiator?
I think, yeah, he joins the conspiracy when he says, I'll take that role.
No, can you be a negotiator and not be a co-conspirator?
Not when you're a member of the FARC representing the FARC. This is not a UN negotiator. This is not some third party that came in from Switzerland.
It's conceptually impossible.
For a FARC member,
right.
Yes, I think
you
so.
You cannot have a FARC, someone who has FARC membership who knows nothing about, I'm not saying this is the case, who knows nothing about the capture and is asked, go and negotiate and see if we can resolve this.
Yes, we think that
would not participate at all, has nothing to do with terms of detention, is not involved in those arrangements. That would not matter in your view.
Yes, because the
yes, it would not matter.
It would go to the type of nullification arguments that have been made, but the crime, the conspiracy to commit hostage taking, does not require any overt act by anyone. And so it certainly wouldn't require that the defendant engaged in any physical act or made those kinds of arrangements. When he agrees to be the face of the FARC negotiating, he becomes a key player. And so, yes, regardless of the fact that he wasn't the person that shot down the plane, he's not guarding them in the jungle, he's prepared, as he said, he's prepared and ready to go to negotiate on behalf of the FARC. That makes him a co-conspirator. Absolutely. I've chronicled for the court the evidence that both with respect to the agreement and the intent to detain, all of that was uncontested. It's true that the trip to Quito was an important part of the case. That trip was evidence from which the jury could infer his intent to participate in the conspiracy. And there, of course, were other freestanding substantive counts that are no longer before this court. And right now, the court's focus is on the conspiracy charge itself. With respect to the conspiracy charge itself, that conduct is further evidence from which the jury could infer his intentional agreement to participate in the conspiracy.
You've made the characterization of the defendant as a negotiator and conspirator dependent on his having been a member of or otherwise associated with the FARC. In other words, if they called George Mitchell and asked him to serve in this capacity, you wouldn't have this argument.
Yes.
So it's only because of his prior involvement with the FARC.
Right. His prior involvement, and then there's also all of this evidence. You know, he admitted it's his goal to achieve the FARC's goals. He accepts all of their policies, and he is in agreement with what the FARC is doing. So, yes, it's nothing like George Mitchell coming in to negotiate, disinterested third party coming to negotiate between these two parties.
If the case is as simple as you are now portraying it, then even more than before, I sit here wondering why all of this inflammatory evidence, the proof of life, the complete proof of life video, the statements by Mano Jojo, Pinchio, highly inflammatory about FARC, having nothing whatsoever to do. You started out with your openings, laid the groundwork, just as co-counsel has said, and where you were going. Your opening statements to the jury were, this is a vile, vicious organization. It may well be true, not doubting that. But that was your setup. FARC's bad, and so it looks like guilt by association. FARC's bad, so he's bad. You're now... If your case is as straightforward as you're saying, all we have to prove is he's a member and he agreed to negotiate. And he even said, if it's true, I don't remember, we shouldn't conclude an agreement unless their demands are met. If it's that straightforward, that's, what, an hour and a half case?
Well, that's the case. That's the case we wanted to try, Your Honor. But we didn't.
But they made you put in inflammatory evidence. You started your opening statement with, to the jury was inflammatory.
Because we knew what was coming. We tried pretrial. The case had been tried once. We tried pretrial to make this a much pared down case. We didn't want to get involved in is it right to characterize this a war? Is it right to characterize these people prisoners of war? Is it right, is this an economic retention or is it a kidnapping? But for the government, it would have been detrimental to the government to stand silent and have the jury led down this path without the government responding in kind to this type of evidence. And then getting more to your particular question, if I might, the proof of life video, first of all, I don't believe the entire video was shown to the jury. I think only small portions of it were. And that's an overt act of the hostage taking itself. That was admissible because that was one of the ways that the hostage taking conspiracy was attempting to compel the Colombian government to capitulate to its demands. And so it was highly, highly relevant. I don't know whether Your Honor has actually watched the video, the 3-minute section where the hostages speak, are asked to speak. I would invite the court and ask the court to do that because it's remarkably unemotional. It's very brief, and there's nothing at all surprising about the remarks they make. And it's highly relevant because the production and distribution of this is, that the whole point is to manipulate the public. So the public clamors for the Colombian government to do what it can.
You had the commander speaking on the video, right?
Yes.
Why did you need more?
Why do we need more? Because no. the whole point is the one of the overt acts of the
statement makes it very clear what's going on, right?
One of the overt. First of all, it's the first time they see the jury sees the victims in the FARC's control. So that's evidence that the FARC has them. And it's
commander's statement doesn't make that point.
It, Your Honor, the whole point that it's an effective tool in the hostage taking and in the manipulation, in the element of the compulsion that we were required to prove that the FARC has got these
totally
people on videotape.
Conspiracy with respect to hostage taking, I'm losing you.
What, I'm sorry.
The commander's statement isn't enough.
No, it isn't enough. It's highly relevant probative evidence that the FARC put these people on videotape, had them make their statements, and then released it publicly so that the public would, there would be this big public outcry. It's part of the compulsion.
It's highly relevant to what that's at issue here.
Element of compulsion.
This hearsay. What is it highly relevant to?
Well, first of all, the victim's statements, to their families, which is what they were complaining about as being very, very inflammatory.
Right.
Those were not admitted for the truth. That was not hearsay. That was the FARC. You know, it's like if there were a murder and the murder happened to be caught on tape, we wouldn't say the videotape of the murder doesn't come in because it's irrelevant and overly prejudicial. This is a snapshot.
I think that's an entirely different case, but go ahead.
Well, this is a snapshot of the hostage taking, and it's one of the things that the co-conspirators did to try to compel the Colombian government to meet its demands. And so it was highly relevant and very probative. It was one of the tools of the hostage-taking conspiracy. If I might just make one point, I wanted to just direct the court to an area of the record. It's not anything we touched on in an argument, and I don't plan to get into it, but at tab 4 of the government's supplemental record material is the pleading that we filed that where we proffer that the activities showed that the co-conspirators intended the absence of the hostages. And that is relevant because in the reply brief for the first time. The activities of the co-conspirators that were designed to absent the witnesses. And that's relevant because in the reply brief.
Absent the witnesses?
From trial, to keep them from trial. In the reply brief for the first time is a claim made that there was no evidence of that. And that's because it wasn't briefed that way. But I wanted to direct the court to tab 4 where it would find the pleading there. If there are no further questions, we'd ask that the conviction be affirmed.
Yeah. Mr. Tucker.
Thank you, Your Honor. Briggs. I'd like to just make two brief points. First of all, as I said before, you really have to look at the record. This claim that we made him do it just doesn't even come close to standing up to the record. And I would ask the court to look at, in between the two trials, because the government did this same stuff in the first trial, and in between there was a status conference because we filed that lengthy motion in limine. And on March 19th, shortly before the second trial, Judge Hogan said to them, and it's at pages 46 and 48, "It's unusual in a case, at least in the court's experience, we have so much 404B evidence in the case. And that's a concern for the court as to looking for direct evidence that implicates a defendant in a crime. It causes some concern." He then goes on to say, "And I wish to keep the case focused on the defendant and his activities and actions involved in the evidence alleged supporting the hostage taking in some fashion, and not in trying the FARC. They're no longer defendants in this case, and not in spending an awful lot of time as to the Americans held as hostage and conditions of confinement." He then goes on to say, "If the government will refocus the case on exactly what the defendant did nor did not do, that will limit his opportunities to talk about what he said." In spite of that, they turned right around in opening statement and did it again. They're almost the exact same opening statement. And if you look at the record, you will see, for instance, all that evidence that I referred to, the witness Avendano, almost all of this evidence that we referred to, the government put that on long before the defense had an opportunity to say, put on any proof. If they were going to put on rebuttal, if it rebutted anything, then there's a proper time for rebuttal or through cross-examination. If you look at this record, you will see that they immediately did this, not only an opening statement, but they put that same witness back up there and started all of this stuff again. Now, this is not an example of we made them do anything. Secondly, as far as the other point I want to make, as far as this harmless error where government counsel stated, well, this was uncontested, that's not true. If you look at Mr. Trinidad's testimony, it was uncontested that the government had proof, for instance, that the April 27th communique said this or that. But he explained in detail that why he made reference to the April 27th communique when he was in Quito. It had nothing to do with that was the reason he was there. He wanted to hopefully for the magistrate there to get that communique and see that he was a member of the FARC because he was afraid that he would be killed or otherwise harmed if he was extradited.
Thank you, Mr. Tucker. Are there further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Tucker, Ms. Hefferman, the case is submitted.